Russia's invasion of Ukraine has shone a light on the challenges of prosecuting war criminals. Global Insight interviewed Professor Philip Leach earlier this year as he was stepping down from his role as director of the European Human Rights Advocacy Centre. Leach, Professor of Human Rights Law at Middlesex University, spoke to us again a month after the conflict began. First, he speaks about the centre's successes and the challenges of holding Russia and other states to account.
Well, thank you, Philip, very much for joining me today. It's almost 20 years since the EHRAC was established, and I just wondered, what was the catalyst really for establishing a dedicated advocacy centre to uphold the rule of law and civil rights in these countries that you've been focusing on: Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, Russia and Ukraine?
Well, the immediate catalyst was Russia, in fact, because, of course, this was a time when Russia had only recently joined the Council of Europe, which was a controversial decision for some, and that, you know, that controversy, of course, continues now. And we linked up with Memorial, one of the largest human rights organizations in Russia, with offices across the country, and started to support them on the very first cases, which were from Chechnya, the cases arising out of the conflict in Chechnya, and again, gross violations being committed by the Russian security forces in Chechnya, and that was how we started, and we set up. And the name, the name gives it away, the European Human Rights Advocacy Centre. We wanted to have a broad geographical remit, and we set up with a view to providing a kind of similar role in support to civil society across other former Soviet states. And in time, developed a project in Georgia and then Armenia and Azerbaijan and Ukraine. And the way we've always done it is to essentially to support NGOs to link up, usually with one or two, a small number of NGOs, with a view to providing some long term support to the human rights lawyers there and to the organisations.
I wondered if you wanted to talk about that a little bit and maybe highlight some of the biggest successes.
Let's start with Chechnya, because that was where we started. And over the years, with Memorial, have taken on many, many cases and won judgments in many, many cases from Chechnya, which have established that the Russian security forces have committed very serious violations of the right to life and the prohibition of torture and so on. And there's been the court has, I think, proved itself, I would say, in very, very difficult circumstances. Very difficult circumstances where it's difficult to get evidence. Very difficult circumstances in the way in which the Russian government deals with these cases. It does engage, it does respond, but it's very limited and partial, and very miserly, if you like. But those cases have, I think, have been very, very significant in establishing what has happened for the families of the victims of those cases, establishing the truth, establishing a historical record, and to a certain extent establishing some accountability, because we have a series of judgments, as I say, setting out what happened and to the extent that's possible saying who was responsible and bringing the government to account, ordering compensation, which the Russian people may be surprised to hear Russian government does pay, even in relation to cases from Chechnya. What's been harder is the other follow-up, the extent to which those cases are then properly investigated. So Chechnya would be one area that I would flag up, and linked to that, of course, is the Beslan case, the case in relation to the school siege in 2004, but also cases like Zakharov, case about state surveillance, which was sort of established in the Grand Chamber judgment, established a precedent internationally for the regulation of state surveillance, and that's been used in the Big Brother litigation and around the world. And in other areas, we've done a lot of work on domestic violence and violence against women and girls, and we took a case against Georgia to the CEDAW committee, the committee under the UN Convention on Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, and was successful in a case called X and Y, and it was the first domestic violence case at CEDAW against Georgia, and led to, you know, changes, which these judgments quite often do, led to changes in law and practice and so on. And I'd also mentioned the Volkov case against Ukraine, a case about political interference with the judiciary, which we're seeing more and more across Europe now. And Mr. Volkov was a Supreme Court judge who was dismissed in ways that the court found was unlawful and politicized. And what was interesting in that case is that the court ordered his reinstatement, which is it's never done before or since. And he was in fact reinstated. It happened after the revolution in Ukraine, so it required a change of government, but it did happen, and I was able to go back to the Supreme Court and meet Mr. Volkov when he was back sitting again as a judge. So a good example of the way in which these decisions can really have impact, both for him and the case also led to a process that's still going on, that changing the law and even the constitution in Ukraine to try to ensure judicial independence.
Have there been any that sort of have really, challenged your belief in the justice system? And how have you and your team motivated yourselves through those times?
You know, we've had applicants who've been threatened and killed. We've had colleagues who've been threatened and killed. One of the terrible examples was, with the case of Natalia Estemirova, who worked for many years for Memorial, working on some of the cases I've described, going to the villages, going to the families and getting testimony. And then she herself was targeted by the Chechen authorities, by Ramzan Kadyrov himself personally, threatened. And in the end, in 2009, she was abducted and murdered. And we've, with Memorial, we've taken a case on behalf of her family, which was certainly partially successful. Most of the Chechen cases have been successful. They've established violations. They've ordered the court has ordered compensation, which has been paid. But beyond that, has there been any political will to make real change on the ground in Chechnya, to investigate these cases and to prevent ongoing impunity? Well, no, there hasn't, and that's extremely difficult to take sometimes. There are, on the other hand, a lot of examples where there is success, and these cases do actually lead both to accountability and redress for the applicants and the families very directly, and lead to wider changes in the law, changes in policy that affect perhaps hundreds of thousands, the whole population. So I think we have to bear that in mind, kind of keep that in check, and be realistic about could expect from the court and the states in response. Human rights implementation is a process. It's not you don't succeed when the judgment comes through. Often that's the beginning of then the process of implementation, which is a whole nother story.
Following Russia's expulsion from the Council of Europe in March, Global Insight spoke to Leach about how this might affect cases pending at the European Court of Human Rights. He also highlighted the need for states to support international efforts to bring justice to the people of Ukraine.
On the 16th of March, we know that the Council of Europe announced that it was expelling Russia as a member after 26 years following the invasion of Ukraine. What are your thoughts on what will be the impact on Russian civilians and civilians from other states that wish to file claims against Russia once the country ceases to be party to the European Convention on Human Rights?
Well, it's clear now that they will be able to take cases about violations right up to September, to 16th September. So the court, the Committee of Ministers, has confirmed that there's this additional 6 months. So that although Russia has been expelled from the Council of Europe, as you say, from 16th March, we've got this extra six-month period. So anything that's occurred during the invasion and right up to 16th September will be subject to the remit of the court. And so cases, well, I think we can expect to see cases being lodged right through that period, and indeed after that, because, of course, to the extent that there's a requirement to exhaust any affected domestic remedies, such as there may be, in some situations people will seek to go
use the domestic courts first and then go to the Strasbourg court. And that'll be fine, provided that the people are complaining about violations that have occurred before 16th of September 2022.
In Russia itself, we've obviously witnessed a huge crackdown on civil society, and this has just intensified seemingly since the invasion. What do you think it means really for some of the cases that are pending at the European Court of Human Rights? We have this foreign agent case, for instance. Does it make it more imperative that the court should prioritise delivering a judgment on this case?
I think very much it does. There are around about 18,000 cases at the moment, or there were 18,000 cases pending against Russia. There will now be, I suspect, many more thousands being lodged right up to September. That's obviously a huge additional burden for the court. It will be essential that the court has to prioritise. It'll have to prioritise cases, the different types of cases related to the current invasion and all, I think, previous cases. I mean, formally, it will be required to deal with them. But it's been able to prioritise for a number of years, and I think it's one of the areas where I would be critical of the court for not doing enough, not being creative enough, I think. And the foreign agents law case is a very good example of that, lodged back in 2013 and still hasn't been decided. In the meantime, we've seen the catastrophic effect the foreign agents law has had on NGOs in Russia. It's a law that's being replicated around the world. So we need the courts. We need the court's precedent on this. I've got no doubt that they will find that it violates the European Convention on Human Rights. We need that strong precedent, and the court should have issued that judgment, many, many years ago, and as a result of which, many NGOs in Russia have gone down. And so I think you're absolutely right that we need to much greater priority. One of the difficult issues, and the other difficult issues, is the extent to which Russia will engage now in the litigation process. It's very difficult to say. Formally, they're required to engage even in the Committee of Ministers meetings discussing implementation of judgments concerning Russia. But whether they will or not, and how they will engage, is to be seen.
In Ukraine itself, obviously time is not standing still, and we're witnessing atrocious kind of atrocities that are being committed. How do you think this conflict has raised the bar for international law and international justice, and can they triumph over Putin's regime in time?
Well, I think the recourse to international legal mechanisms has been extraordinary. We've seen, just in the few weeks since the invasion started, we've seen the International Court of Justice, the European Court of Human Rights, and the International Criminal Court all being activated, all starting and instigating proceedings. We've had two sets of interim measures from the European Court and the International Court of Justice. So I think it's a validation of those systems. Of course, there's a real limit to what they can do on the ground at the time. But as you say, they are some of the only mechanisms and means we have to counter the brutal use of force that we're seeing in Ukraine. But I think it's extraordinary that the International Criminal Court is already investigating, that two courts have issued orders against the Russian authorities to stop, particularly stop the targeting of civilians and civilian objects. And so I think it's to the credit of Ukraine to try to use those mechanisms. I think the other thing that it underlines is the importance of these international human rights systems globally. We need them now more than ever. And what it underscores is the need for states to give these systems proper support. We don't always see that. We don't see that in the way in which judgments remain unimplemented for many, many years. We see sometimes even hostility from states, and states picking and choosing the judgments that they do and don't like. Of course, the ones they don't like, they will jump up and down about and object to. You can't have a system, international legal human rights system, where states pick and choose. You have to take the rough with the smooth. It includes the UK. We've seen the UK jumping up and down about prisoner voting rights. We see now Turkey in relation to the detention of Osman Kavala and Selahattin Demirtas, the politician, the president of Turkey, denying the authority of the court. You can't have a system where that happens. So we need to double down, and we need to get states to support these mechanisms, because we realize in a situation at the moment how fundamentally important they are.